intrigued about Dr. Cole. You know, it's, I was here when Bob Huntley was president, so I have a pretty good
sense. A good friend of Dr. Cole's, too.
Well, and I've interviewed him, and so I have a pretty good sense of that administration, and Dr. Gaines is just legendary. But it's almost, I don't want to say a black hole, but sort of a brown hole, the Cole administration. Mm-hmm. And the more you can tell me about that, the better educated I'll be.
I don't know if you've heard about any of the personal characteristics of Dr. Cole. Well, he's the only man that I've ever seen smoking 3 cigarettes at one time. You'd walk into that office where the president's office was until Dr. Wilson moved, and you could hardly see across the room. I was a smoker, so it didn't... I was not as concerned about that when I was smoking as I would be today or anyone else. Well, you wouldn't go in the room. It was just... But he would have one in his mouth, one in his hand, and one in an ashtray. And it was just like a constant cigarette that he never let out. Poor man died of, I'm sure, complications because of it. But so that was a personal characteristic. Beautifully groomed, always the finest suits and looked fine. One-to-one, he could be very personable, but in a group, he was very uncomfortable. And that's why the alumni never really took to Dr. Cole, because he was just not comfortable. He would have Frank write his speeches. I guess Frank wouldn't. I'm not sure Frank wrote some of them. And he just was not a public figure. But he could stand and have vision. He's the one that I think brought us out of the dark ages in terms of faculty and salaries, recognizing what the university needed in terms of upgrading its faculty, upgrading salary. He was excellent at that kind of thing. And he is, can certainly be given credit for it. He had a vision, and I'll tell you this, I don't know that it's written down anywhere, or he ever said anything. I walked into his office one day, and he was looking. I'm trying to acclimate this, but if Washington Hall is there, his office was on the back of Washington, overlooking the ravine to where now the law school is. At one time, he visualized, how they call them, coordinate college for women there that would could be a part of Washington and the university, but would be a separate college for women before we went co-ed. So he really had that vision of us eventually becoming a co-ed institution. I swear, I'm positive of that. And, or at least I felt that in what he said to me. We traveled together. He was a good friend. He was just, but he was not a public figure. And Mrs. Cole worked so hard on anything that she did in that Lee house had to be absolutely perfect. And she worked so hard to achieve it that by the time it occurred, she was a nervous wreck. Poor thing. She's still alive. She came by him few months ago and stopped over in the Reeves Center because she had known, she met Mr. and Mrs. Reeves once. So I was anxious to hear her comments about that.
Now, was it during the Cole administration that President Truman came?
President Truman. It would have to be during Cole's administration, because Dr. Gaines was only here for a year, and I don't think it occurred when Dr. Gaines was here. Arnold Toynbee came when Dr. Gaines was still in office, but President Truman spoke at a mock convention. Everyone was disappointed because it was such a mild talk compared to what they thought it was going to be. I can't tell. It must have been during that, and I'm thinking, could it have been during the period of Dr. Pusey's interim acting presidency that he was here, but I know I know that Mr. Nixon came during Pusey's administration, that short period in there between Cole and Huntley.
Uh-huh. He was here in 68. I have a number of pictures.
Yeah. Well, that would be.
So what was it like having that level of? Of course, we had so many interesting people come to campus. Were you involved in hosting any of those people?
And certainly not. Neither Nixon or Truman. I can remember being involved with Goldwater when he came, but no, I was not involved in that area of the university at all at that point.
Now, were you
most here? Of that was done by students. That was really a student affair. If you were invited to something, you certainly went to it, and in those kind of looking, but nothing to do with the arrangements, anything like that. That was all done with the students.
Now, were you here when Toynbee was here?
Yes. I was here only for his last public appearance in Lee Chapel. And then the Gaines had a reception in their home after that affair. And it seemed to me that it was being covered. It was a national magazine here, or the staff from a national magazine covering Toynbee. I don't recall which one it was. All of a sudden, National Geographic comes to mind, but I don't think it was National Geographic. It was another. But I'd heard so much about Toynbee. But that last lecture he gave was not a sold-out event. Well, some of them, of course, when he first came, getting a ticket to hear Toynbee was, I'm sure. But there again, Frank was the one. Involved, I believe, as anyone on the campus at the time. But going back to women, let me do that.
Please do.
Mrs. Evans, lovely lady, an heir to the part of the Coca-Cola fortune through her marriage to Mr. Whitehead, and then she later married Mr. Evans, who we've got Evans Hall. The Remus Gymnasium, funds for that came before I arrived here, but came through both Mr. and Mrs. Doreen, so she was very much a part of that gift. And that story has been told and retold so many times. So that was before I came. I'm just trying to think of women and names on this campus. Newcomb Hall, that Mrs. Newcomb from, I guess, New Orleans, gave the funds for in honor of her husband in Newcomb Hall, but Sophie Newcomb. The college, Sophie Newcomb in New Orleans, is the name of the lady who gave us really the money for Newcomb Hall. That's another lady. Lewis, that's Francis and Sidney Lewis, but there again is this lady that was very close to the university. But there's some others. Of course, the ones that I'm most familiar with would be the Reeves, Mrs. Reeves, who was the ultimate donor of the Reeves collection, Mrs. Watson of the Watson Pavilion, great lady. Some other ladies, I'm forgetting some of these angels. Anyway, one time I made a list of all these people. Seems to me there's something to do with, no, but I mean, those are the ones who are recognized that have been large contributors to the university in one way or another.
Miss Parmley.
Parmley, that's the lady. She was great.
Tell me about Miss
Parmley. She was great. You've heard this from everybody, but she was just absolutely super. I may be the only person that ever spent the night with Miss Parmley, but not in her room, but in her apartment. I had a meeting in New York, and it came up in the library. I couldn't get a room in any hotel. Miss Palmley had asked me to help her with getting sometimes some transportation things, and you could get it in Lexington. That's unbelievable. But in New York, she couldn't get it because just the throngs of people that were trying to get things. And I could do some things for her here, which I didn't. Well, I had to go to New York, and I called and I said, "Miss Palmer, I'm having a very difficult time getting a place to stay. Do you have any suggestions?" "You stay right here." She said, "There's a guest room here in 825 Fifth Avenue." Well, the guest room really was what had been the maid's room for one of the people that was not, and it could be used for that. So I stayed until about midnight in that room. It had no window. And I got up and walked on over to the plaza about midnight and said, and there was no bath. And so I asked them at the plaza if they had, and they did, and I checked in there because there were only a couple of blocks from where I was. But anyway, I spent part of the night with Miss Palmer. But a party for Miss Palmer at our house is Bob Keefe's favorite story. Here again, it was sort of like the Mrs. DuPont. Miss Palmer was coming. This is when Bob Huntley's president. And he and Miss Palmer got along fine. He'd get along fine with anybody, but she was coming, so we were going to have a dinner party for this old house of ours. Well, maybe, certainly wouldn't have been over 14, because that was all we could seat at the table. And so everybody kept telling me everything we should do and all that, so I loaded up on every conceivable, the brandy, and I thought, she would like scotch. I had everything right. So here I am. Miss Palmley arrives. I don't believe I'd seen Miss Palmley at this particular time, ever seen her before. She arrived at the house and came in. And that's when we had drinks in the library then. Miss Palmley came in, and everybody else had been there for some time before she arrived. And I'd already given them something to drink. And I said, "Miss Palmley, may I pick you a drink?" She said, "That would be nice." I said, "What would you like?" She said, "I'd like a bottle of beer." I didn't have a cold bottle of beer at the house. I went back and threw a can in the freezer and wrapped ice around and did everything else. But Bob Keith likes to kid me about that one, about giving Miss Palmer. Then after we became friends, a very wealthy lady living with her mother most of her life and not doing anything that I could figure out would be fun. I'm sure she did many things that she enjoyed doing, like hiking and saving islands off of Georgia and developing beaver dams in Vermont and New Hampshire, but she had never had an opportunity to attend anything some of the things in New York she liked to do. Bob Huntley, when he'd go, he would ask her where she'd like to go to have dinner or something. She'd tell him. I was going up one time. I said, "Miss Palmer, where would you like to have lunch?" She said, "I'd like to go to 21. So it's pouring rain. Oh, it just rained. And I'm staying at some hotel, and I got a cab to go over to 825. And when I got out of the cab to go in to usher her out, I stepped in water that came up halfway up to my knee. I mean, it was running by the curb. Well, that didn't matter. I go in, and here's Miss Palmley. She's got a ski cap on, pulled way down over. She's got a rubber boots and an old coat, and here I am taking her to 21, thinking that, oh, Lord, that place was. So when I walked in, I'd made a reservation through Ross Millhiser, who had friends there. So the people weren't as shocked as I was, but anyway, this couple, wringing wet, had come in, and they took us to the best seat in the house. And next to us placed Van Johnson, who was, you probably don't remember Van Johnson, but anyway, Van Johnson was a movie star. She was so thrilled. I don't think she could eat. Being in this place that she'd always wanted to, and then sitting next to a movie star, one like Van Johnson, who was so nice to her, because it was on one of these banks, we were seated on a long, whatever it is, along a wall. And he was right next to her, and he started a conversation with her. But what a wonderful lady. What a wonderful lady. What a wonderful lady.
Well, you know, I have some pictures of her here, and she just looks so delightful.
Isn't she nice?
She has this angelic smile. She looks like a cherub.
She does. And I think she told me the two things that she had enjoyed most was her association with Washington Lee, which came late in life, and this island off of Georgia that she had helped save as a preserve. Those are the two things that came from my life. And it was through an alumnus of ours that she became generous to Washington Lee, who was, I guess, counseling her own her estate to be and so forth, and mentioned Washington and Lee. And she had heard about Washington and Lee through her father talking about Mr. and Mrs. Remus and what they'd done to this school. She loved General Lee as well. So no one person is ever responsible for a gift. I mean, it takes a lot of people working together. It's the total group that brings about happy situations. All of us would love to think that we were totally responsible for it, but that's not true. Not true. All right.
Well,
there was another lady that I liked. Ms. Gottwald. Ms. Gottwald is an angel. It was her money that made possible the Reeves Center. So she would certainly.
I don't know Gottwald. Who is she?
Mrs. Floyd D. Gottwald is the wife of Floyd D. Gottwald, Jr., who was president and chairman of the Ethel Corporation. And he was a BMI alumnus on the board of directors and awarded board of governors. And but they had two sons that came to Washington and Lee. The family's tradition was BMI, but they had two sons that came here. And once when they were here for Parents Weekend, Celeste and I were at the same table with them over in Evans Hall in the private dining room over there, and I mentioned this collection of ceramics that had been given to the university, and they both indicated they would love to see it. So it was in a basement at that time, and I took them down in the basement, and they opened some of the cartons that the stuff was in. And we became friends. Then when I found the paintings that Louise Herrsoff had painted, she saw those, and she really, and both of them then were very excited, and she said they'd be happy to give her a show at their home in Richmond, which was where they had a gallery almost. Well, it was a nice place. We didn't do that because we were able to have a one-woman show at the Corcoran. But when I always said we had a collection in search of a home, and that's what it was. And I'd talked to them several times, and they'd asked me what was going to come of this, and I thought, well, the way things are going, we had so many needs at Washington Lee that certainly a place to house dishes was unheard of. So I asked one day, they had been asked to give to the new library, to the Commerce School, to the law school, and they did not have any interest, so I talked to Bob Huntley one day, and I said, I know you've never given me permission to ask for funds from anyone that was a prospect for all of our other needs here, but I said, would you permit me to talk to the Gottwalds? He said, you won't get a damn penny from them. And I said, well, let me try. So Celeste and I make an appointment to see them. They were at their beach home in Virginia Beach, and we drove over, and I showed them a little model that I'd had made up, and they gave us the money to restore the building for that purpose without letting us put their name on it. They didn't want it. I mean, they're that kind of people. So that was a gift of almost $500,000 to do that. Then down the road, they made a gift of, I think it was $750,000 to endow the directorship, which was my position. And that was their second gift. And then after that, I think when I retired, I never knew the amount, but I think it was enough to bring that probably up to $1 million, maybe a little more. And then at another point, they gave another major gift. So they were very good to the Reeves Center. Mrs. Floyd D. Gottwald, Libby. She's still alive. She's one of the few ladies that, along with Francis Lewis, is alive. So that was that one. Then Miss Watson, after we got the collection, she and her husband came over and had lunch at Bill Puse's house. He was acting president, I think, at the time. And I showed him the basement where all the porcelain was stored. And by that time, the paintings. And she and her husband had lived in the Orient, and they invited us to come over to Lynchburg to see theirs. And then over a period of years, she became friends and would travel with us. That was the key to the support of the Reeves Center. The Gottwalls traveled with the students every spring when we'd take them to some special place. We had another couple in South Carolina, the Carters, that financed it. And then Miss Watson traveled with us, and they saw what happened to these young people when their eyes were opened to art and these different great collections that we tried to expose them to. So Mrs. Watson's gift was a major gift to the university. Probably around $3 million, I imagine. The building and an endowment and a professorship begins to add up. So I think it's around $3 million. So that was that one.
Now, help me to understand. The porcelain that's in the Watson Center is part of the Reeves collection.
Some of it is. Some of it in the while we had hoped, and I hope that it will continue, that the Watson Pavilion would be an extension of the Reeves Center in, to the extent that it would take us back in time in the history of ceramics to the Neolithic period. That's where I wanted to start, and that's the big jug that you see over there that Celeste and somebody else, I had to have somebody help because I couldn't have done it by myself. We bought that because that's where it really begins and then comes forward up to the 17th and 18th century. But part of it in that building belonged to Mrs. Watson, some of it belonged to to the Reeves collection, and then other additions have come from the McBrides that lived in Blacksburg, of all places, but now in Florida. That, and Tom was very active in getting that collection on display there by the time the building opened.
Tom Litzenberg?
Tom Litzenberg, right. And he's more acquainted with the McBrides. They met me once when they came up here to see the Reeves collection. I let them in and showed them around. But Tom really worked more closely with them and continues to do so.
All right, now let me
Go ahead. Give
me the story. You mentioned the building that the Reeves Center is in. Are we okay?
Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned the building. What was that building originally?
It was built in 1842 as a faculty house and remained a faculty residence until, really was a faculty residence when I came here. One professor, Dr. Howe, that Howe Hall is named for, lived in the house for 55 years. Built in 1842 for $3,500, those four houses that two on each side of the colonnade.
Each one was built for $3,500?
Each one was built for $3,500 in 1842. My figures, I'm getting old, I may be off on, but I think that's about right. Mm-hmm. 1842, and they served in that capacity really up until the only one now that's a faculty home is Howison's. It was usually seniority in terms of faculty that were able to live in the houses. And this was, but before the Reeves Center, before we restored it to the Reeves Center, it was an extension of the law school. There were some law school offices in it, as well as religion and some other departments. So it served for a while as a classroom, or faculty offices mainly.
Okay. And which house did Leyburn live in?
He was in the Reeves Center.
He was in that house?
He was in that house, and he was the last faculty occupant of the house. It was just falling down.
So after law school?
After Leyburn, faculty offices, including one time the archaeology group was in there, and then they were some in there from religion department, and then I think mainly law school mm-hmm. offices where they, as the law school began to expand and before they moved into the new building.
Right.
So it was a faculty. It's the only one that was used for that purpose of the four. Now the one that Howison is in, the Dean of Students, is the Lee Jackson House, has always remained that. The, I didn't get on Ms. Morris, but anyway, Ms. Morris is another name. Surely don't want to forget her. That house was a faculty home until it was restored for the guest house. She and her husband are from Houston. Mrs. Morris loves history, preservation, restoration. She and her husband always entertain at wherever they are, these national meetings of their particular company are held. He's with, they own Stewart Title Company, which is a mortgage insurance company. They have offices in over 2,000. She wrote to the president who was in Wilson and said she would like to bring a group of guests to Lexington. Am I right about this? It was before Wilson. It was before Wilson. Maybe Bob Hunt, for entertainment, and so he, and would like for them to have, be able to see Lee Chapel and so forth. So he turned the letter over to Captain Peniston, and he turned it over to me. And I thought, well, there's no reason not to try to accommodate these people. So I called this lady in Houston and told her, yes, that we could arrange for it. Could she give me some details about the dates and our organization? She said, yes. She said, we'd like to bring them over, and I'd like for them to have lunch in the Lee House with General Lee. I said, well, that's not possible. I said, that's a private residence for our president. I'm sure it was during Bob Hunter, because they moved out and used it only for entertaining. I said, that won't be possible. She said, well, I'd certainly like to do it. So, Ms. Morris, that won't be possible. And so then she went on to the next thing, what she wanted to do, and she said, said, why don't you come up here? You've never been to Lexington, and just see what it's like. Well, I went to the airport to meet this lady, and she got off the plane, and she's this tall, strawberry blonde, big lady, graceful though big, with this high-pitched voice. And everyone thought, boy, you're dealing with a real dizzy blonde. Well, what had happened? She'd had an operation on her throat that causes her to do this. Smart as a whip, I found out. Well, anyway, she got off, we came over here, and the more I was with her, the more I liked what she had in mind, but I said, you just can't, that's not possible. She said, well, Jim, do you think, well, anyway, she had a certain way about it. Well, the way it turned out, her guest list at the homestead included 125 people that she had buses sent. I mean, they had the big buses bring them to Lexington. They arrived. They both loved carriages and horses, and they had friends in Virginia that had these big carriages and so forth come into Lexington, and we had a parade downtown, and the horn blower that they brought up from Texas. They went, they arrived at about 11:30, and we had lunch at the Lee House. We had it. Sat them on the porch and all around, and these people from all over the country had never been in any place like that. Then after lunch, Pam Simpson gave them a tour of the campus and the historic buildings, and they went through the Reeves Center. They went through the Reeves. No, we didn't even have the Reeves Center. It was just before we opened. And then took them downtown, and they had a, I had the mayor give them a proclamation in Lee Chapel, and got the city to put up the flags, and we called it Stewart Title Day, and they were very impressed, and we became friends. And later, they came up shortly after that for the dedication of the Reeves Center, and I took Stewart around, and I could tell he was a very sensitive type man, and I'd talk about Lee and Washington, and every now and then he'd have to wipe a tear. Well, then he asked me if I would speak to that organization, a similar organization in Boston, to God in the museum, and I said, yeah. He said, well, I'll pick you up in our plane. He was flying his own jets at the time, so he and Joel, my name was Joel, picked Celeste me up in Roanoke and flew us to Boston. And as we were making our approach to Boston, we were at about 30,000 feet. I said, Stuart, I've had something on my mind. I said, Washington and Lee needs an official guest house. Would you think about restoring one of those historic houses that you saw when you were up there, exactly like the Reeve Center, as a guest house in honor of Joella? And the plane almost did a nosedive. But anyway, we landed and didn't hear a word from them. And then they came to a meeting where I was speaking in Natchez, Mississippi, and he said, have breakfast with us tomorrow morning. When I got there, he had a folded piece of yellow tablet on it. Said, dear Jim White, I give you $250,000 to restore the Morris House. So that's the way that got restored. So I do think in that case, I did have a little something to do with it. But the rest of it took a lot of people working hard.
You had him more than over a barrel. You had him over a planet.
I really did. But they're such nice people, great people. He was at Washington with me this past weekend and we dedicated a new 16-sided barn, Mount Vernon. That's been my outlet, has been Mount Vernon in the volunteer capacity. And that's a great institution.
I read about that.
Oh, you did? I have not seen a thing about it.
I read.
Because I haven't seen any papers.
Oh, it was written up in the Post. There was quite a write-up.
Oh, I'll have to look it upstairs. Because it would have been, although a lot of news media was there, but I had no idea.
It might have been last.
Well, it was dedicated last Friday, so it had to be in Saturday or Sunday's paper.
Well, or it might have been in the home section last week, the tabloid
section.
Yeah,
right.
I think it might have been that. My husband was reading all about it. Yeah. He was reading out loud to me.
Oh, they did such a beautiful job. They had Somerville, who has done things here for us, who acts as Washington and thinks he is Washington. Mm-hmm. He looks like one. And his farm, see, Washington's great love was farming. That was number one. Mm-hmm. And they had, maybe 500 school children in different colored t-shirts sitting on bales of hay in front of the barn. And each, as they came around, they had them, each given them a little stack of wheat to take in to put in the barn before the horses went in and so forth. Roger Mudd, who's on the advisory committee up there with me, was a master of ceremonies. And oh, what a beautiful occasion. And then they had the children, each with one of the animals, well, a pig or a lamb, and then there were sheep and so forth, walk up with this and tell George Washington why they were so important to farming and so on. I think if they'd have passed a plate, we could have raised we've got to raise $60 million anyway, but it was just, and Kellogg provided the funds for this. They gave us the money to do the barn. Unfortunately, there had been an old photograph that had been saved by somebody that showed what the barn looked like as it was deteriorating. And, well, I'll have to look up in the library and see in their papers. They keep them.
Well, it was in the Post. I know it was written up.
Yeah, it was great about it.
And I just took things to the recycling center, or I'd bring it to you.
Yeah, that's all right.
All right, now,
you've
one
had
story.
For today.
Are you done? Because
No, I'm all right. I have to go to the hospital to be with my son around 4:00.
Okay, I know that, but I would love to have just a few minutes, and it's probably a much longer story than that. But let's get the essence of the Reeve story. I have a question. I got to tell you, whenever I have visitors come to see me, the highlight of the tour is to take them to the Reeve Center.
Thank you.
It is my favorite thing on this campus. I love those paintings.
Right, okay.
The porcelain is one thing.
Porcelain.
But the paintings just tear me up.
That's right. Porcelain is a known factor. You can research it, and it's been around for a long time, since 900 AD. And it's all chronicled. But to find somebody that was...
Tell me about
an artist that. Like that.
Tell me.
I've told you this story.
No, you have not told it to me.
Okay.
Please.
Well, you can't start. You can't tell the story unless you start at the beginning. a postal card, a penny postal card, arrived at this university. I think in the alumni office, but anyway, Dr. Cole is president, and I'm assistant to the president. I'm not treasurer at the time, but I'm assistant to the president. My major job as assistant to the president was to keep peace between the office of the president and the treasurer, if you really want to know the truth. That was the major job, because it would, Mr. Mattingly could never accept what was happening to the, I mean, at the university, although it was all good, it was still impossible for him to go beyond the gains years in terms of his way of thinking. Okay, this postal card arrives and it says, as best I can remember, "Someday I may wish to give a work of art to the university. Are you interested? Question mark. Signed, Hugh Greaves, Class 27 Law." That's all it said. Well, that card went around from office to office and finally came into my hands. And I thought, well, when you said gift, that caused me to give it a little more attention. And President Cole and I were going to be in New York for a meeting with our advisor at U.S. Trust Company, Henry Grady. So I called Mr. Reeves, this man that had written the card in Providence, and said, "Mr. Reeves, I'm going to be in New York with Dr. Cole in early February. Would it be possible to come by to see you?" "I'd love to have you come," he said. Southern accent. He was from South Carolina. So the date was set, and I called, and he said, "Try to arrive in time for lunch." You want to redo that? So I thought, well, on the map, Providence looked like it was a suburb of New York, and it was not. And I went over to Grand Central, picked up a ticket, and got on it, and it took until about noon to get to Providence. But in any event, it was cold, ice cold. It was just terrible. Snow everywhere. And I get in a cab and tell him I want to go to 89 Benevolent Street. And a cab driver, obviously a very talented driver, he ever started up, I think it's called College Hill, past all these magnificent federal houses. It was just like going into another century, these magnificent mansions, as well as some of the houses that were built at the time of the Revolution there, Benefit Street and Waterman and Hope Street, all those kind of things. So he started climbing that hill, and I just kept looking, and I thought, gosh, I wonder what in the world he has to give us, because my only connection with art, I had no knowledge of art whatsoever, was that the university had a Peale portrait of George Washington and a Wollaston of Martha's family. I thought, I wonder if he has a Copley or a Peale or something like that. Well, he drives up by these men, then turns a corner and pulls up in front of this, when I was straight in front of this little house. You've seen the picture. And that's a wonderful picture of the house. It doesn't look nearly that good. And that day it looked far worse. But anyway, it was a little one room wide, 2.5 story, wood shingled little house. And I said to the driver, "Is this 89 Benevolent Street?" He said, "Yes." I said, I don't think so. And he says, "There's no North Benevolent, or no South Benevolent, no East Benevolent, no West Benevolent. This is the only Benevolent Street." I said, "Okay, we'll keep the motor running. I'm going to the door to find out if we're at the wrong place. I may be wrong about the address." And I knocked on this door that was flush with the front sidewalk. It was right on the sidewalk. No, the sidewalk was right at the house. There was a Christmas wreath on there. This now is February, and it was dried and had reached a point of decay. And I knocked on the door, and this, finally a voice came, the door opened, and this real dark-eyed and dark-haired man opened the door. And I thought, "Is that Mr. Reeves? I know now I'm at the wrong house." And then I heard a voice say, "Is that you, Jim Whitehead? I hope you've come to stay 2 weeks." And that was Mr. Reeves. And I walked into a vestibule that was only 4 feet wide, 4 foot wide. And there was a table there, and here was Mr. Reeves, his handyman, Whitehead, and a barking dog. And the dog was just, it was a little toy Boston Bull Terrier. And the dog was so excited, he was jumping vertically. And just, it was unbelievable. But all four of these, three grown men and a dog plus a table. And I couldn't see where I was because I'd just come out of the ice and hit him in a dark house. He said, "I hope you come to stay 2 weeks. Joe has rented the guest room." And oh my God, if I stay more than 2 minutes, it's longer than I want. And so I walk in. And from the vestibule, he guides me. And I've got on a coat, and I pull it like this, you know, from knocking things off. He sat me down in a chair. And the webbing had, he had to move some porcelain and magazines out of the chair. And when I sat in it, I almost was on the floor. I don't know that anybody had been in that chair in years other than just stuffing powder. And he sat on a little day bed right across from me and started talking about Washington and Lee and how he loved it and so forth. And that's when our relationship began.
And what was he like?
Well, he really was seemed to be completely out of place in those surroundings. He was dressed in a very nice pinstripe. He had on a white starched shirt, and he had a silk tie with a diamond stick pin. And all around was this old faded wallpaper that was peeling off the walls. No item that had been touched to clean or to dust in years. And so crowded that you could not move. And yet he spoke with a very soft southern accent he'd never lost, but continually talking about his wonderful years at Washington Lee. In fact, Mr. Mattingly and Mr. Gillum, who was the dean then, both said to me, "Jim," said, "you're on a wild goose chase. Euclid Reeves will never do anything worthwhile for Washington Lee." They'd remembered him as a student in the law school, and he did have a good time when he was here. He was a college Joe if there ever was one. But that day, he was a scholar.
We're going to switch tapes quickly.
All right.